From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. As the first black man to make it to the top of the tennis world, Arthur Ashe made sports history. Now Ashe has written a history of African-American athletes called A Hard Road to Glory. Arthur Ashe tells us his story on this edition of Fresh Air. Also today, I speak with one of the pioneers of West Coast dance, Bella Lewitsky. Now in her 70s, she still has her own company, and she's a founder of what will be the most comprehensive dance complex in the U.S. when it opens. Critic at Large Laurie Stone examines Jay Leno both as a stand-up comic and as a talk show host. And 1989 in Review, a satirical look back on a year that hasn't happened yet. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Tennis star Arthur Ashe has written a history of the African-American athlete called A Hard Road to Glory. He says, discrimination, vilification, incarceration, dissipation, ruination, and ultimate despair have dogged the steps of the mightiest of these heroes. I spoke with Ashe about his own hard road to glory. Ashe started competing in tennis in the 1950s, when the courts in his home state of Virginia were still segregated, and the world of professional tennis was, for all practical purposes, a white world. Ashe became the first black man to win the U.S. Open and Wimbledon. His playing career ended at the age of 36 in 1980 after a heart attack and quadruple bypass surgery. Since that time, he served as captain of the U.S. Davis Cup team and national campaign chairman for the American Heart Association. Arthur Ashe has written several books, including an autobiography and a tennis diary called Portrait in Motion. He got drawn into writing a history of black athletes when he discovered how little was written on the subject. As he did his research, he came upon many stereotypes that have been used against blacks in sports.
The strongest health stereotype was in baseball. Mm-hmm. No question about that. Baseball emerged very quickly as the national pastime, followed closely by football after a while. But in baseball, the players and some owners went to great lengths to keep blacks out, and the stereotypical reason was that they were not good enough or were afraid. For instance, even in boxing, one of the reasons that Jim Corbett back in the late 1890s and John L. Sullivan gave for not fighting blacks is that they had a yellow streak. And obviously Jack Johnson, the first black heavyweight champion, put all this to rest. But that was what people wanted to believe, and it was chiefly as a result of stereotypes publicized about in magazines and newspapers.
Now, you basically grew up on a sports field. Your father was a special police officer of the largest public park for blacks in Richmond, Virginia.
Correct.
Did that help get you interested in tennis? Were there tennis courts in this park?
Yes. There were four tennis courts at this 18-acre park, and we actually lived on this park. And there was also an Olympic-sized pool, a basketball court, a large utility field, three baseball diamonds, and two football fields. And that's where I grew up. So I was sort of totally immersed in sports as a child.
You've written that, like most blacks, you grew up believing that a lot of jobs were off-limits for blacks. What about sports, and specifically what about tennis?
Well, when I became 10, 11, 12 years old, we're talking about the early to mid-50s now, the color line had been broken in the major team sports. There was already a broken line of sorts in boxing and track, but it had not been broken until that period between 1946 and 1950 in basketball, football, baseball, tennis, golf, bowling, and some others. And so I was a sports nut as a child and able to follow the exploits of a Jackie Robinson or Althea Gibson. And in that respect, I was quite fortunate. But not knowing that, had I been born just 2 or 3 years earlier, that would not have been the case.
How did tennis become your sport?
I was always a very good little athlete. I was fast and I was quick, but I was not very big.
Mm-hmm.
So I was not going to play football. I wasn't tall enough to really do that well in basketball. I learned how to swim at a very early age, but was not that interested. Soccer was no longer, was not popular yet. And I also played tennis, I think, because it was not a team sport. It was just me by myself out there alone. And I also, in addition, believe that I gravitated towards sports and books as a way to get over the death of my mother, which occurred when I was just 6 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I think books and sports may have saved me from going slightly nuts.
You've pointed out that when you were coming of age, blacks really had no identification with the sport of tennis. And I was wondering if that was ever an obstacle to your appreciation of the sport.
Not really. I knew who the black sports heroes were in the field of tennis. People like Jimmy McDaniel. Of course, we were all aware of Althea Gibson and very proud of her for having blazed the trail. And I knew some of the other very good black players. But all of us knew that we wanted to play at Forest Hills or wanted to play in the Davis Cup or wanted to play at Wimbledon. And in the late 40s, that was just not possible. But that didn't stop us from wanting to realize our dreams in any event.
Did anyone ever try to discourage you and tell you that there was very little room for black players in the sport?
No, not discouragement to the extent of saying stop because there's only so high you can go, no. But it was certainly pointed out that there were no, with the exception of Althea, there were no black role models that you could point to that had gone as far as she had gone, especially no men, no men at all, completely none.
It's funny because it's usually the opposite way, right?
Yes, yes, most sports. Yes, that's exactly right. But and it's still that way today. That is, to the extent that there may be more black participation in the sport like in a sport like tennis in the future, I think most of the participation in the next decade or so will be females rather than males.
If you're just joining us, my guest is tennis star Arthur Ashe, who retired from the sport a few years ago after quadruple bypass. He has just written a 3-volume history of the African-American athlete, and it's called A Hard Road to Glory. What was the world of black tennis like when you started to play?
Well, it was a very self-contained world, largely confined to the East Coast cities of Durham, North Carolina, Richmond, Washington, Baltimore, Philadelphia, Montclair, New Jersey, New York City, New Haven, Connecticut, Boston. There were some outposts in Wilberforce, Ohio. Any place in the South that had a black college was a mecca for black tennis. And Kansas City and Los Angeles. And, oh yes, those Houston and Dallas were meccas, and Prairie View, Texas, because that was the site of a rather large black college, Prairie View A&M. And those were the places where blacks congregated from year to year, summer to summer, to play and to socialize, meet one another. And that went on from 1916, and it continues until this very day.
Were there tournaments that you wanted to play in that you were barred from because of segregation?
Oh, sure. Oh, yes. I was barred from all official sanctioned events in my home state. In fact, I only played in one sanctioned event in my home state as a junior player in my life. That was when I was 18, and I came back to play in the National Interscholastics, that is the national tournament for high school athletes. That was held in Charlottesville, Virginia in 1961. That's the only integrated or sanctioned event I ever played in my own home state as a junior.
Tennis is the sport perhaps most associated with the upper class, and I think that perhaps in black tennis and in white tennis, when you were starting out, that a lot of the players were from well-to-do families.
Yes, that also made a huge difference as far as tennis was concerned. I also think it has a lot to do with the longevity of the American Tennis Association, for instance, which is the black national body that has held black tennis together since 1916. I mean, the American Tennis Association has the longest history of any other black American sports body in continuous operation. The only other one would be the athletic conference that ties together the schools and the Central Intercollegiate Athletic Association, which was begun in 1912. But the reason I say that is implied in your question, and that is because most of the people who played were college graduates. They were members of the very small but influential black professional class.
Well, you are from the middle class. And your father was a police officer.
My family was lower middle class, and there's no question. My father had a sixth grade education, but had a very respectable job, and we were not poor by any means.
But did that make you something of an outsider even in the world of black tennis?
No, no. Uh-huh. There was a pretty good mix, but almost all of the officers and the people who had positions of authority in black tennis in the American Tennis Association, almost all of them were college graduates. Almost all of them, and they all played. And they just saw to it that they were going to keep this group going, keep the tournaments going, and they did. But there were many players from other countries, for instance. There are a lot of Panamanians, black Panamanians, who came up to play. There are some from the Caribbean who came to play. And quite a few of those who are influential were first and second generation Americans from the West Indies. The West Indian influence was quite pronounced.
Because of the class associations with the game, when did you have to learn a certain code of behavior associated with the upper classes?
No, we adopted the same code of ethics that the white tennis body used, and that code was steeped in Victorian English tradition.
Uh-huh.
And we went along with it, but it made sense, especially since the principles that one would hear, the moral codes that one would hear in the black church, would be very similar to what is espoused by Victorian England. Modesty, obey the Ten Commandments, honor your father and your mother, don't do anything that would embarrass your family. And I don't think black tennis players had any difficulty adhering to that.
You were the first black to win many of the titles that you won. You were the first black to win the Junior Davis Cup, the first black to get a UCLA tennis scholarship, the first black to win Wimbledon. I think the first also to win...
Black man.
Black man, okay, right.
Yes.
Also the same for the U.S. Open. What were some of the pressures that went along with being the first black or first black man to win some of these titles?
Well, the pressures were more closely associated with certain time periods.
Uh-huh.
I felt enormous pressure in the 60s because that was the decade of the era of the black social revolution. That's when Dr. King started his crusades, and you had your sit-ins and your freedom rides and summer trips to Selma, Alabama, and you had the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act coming into being in 64 and 65. And Malcolm X was in his heyday, and the Vietnam War, and Muhammad Ali refusing to cross the line for induction to the U.S. Army, and Tommy Smith and John Carlos raising their fists at Mexico City at the Olympics. So against the background, the context of the 1960s, I felt enormous pressure to contribute to black social progress. In the 1970s, it all but disappeared. Any pressure one may have felt then, anybody black may have felt, was self-inflicted, self-imposed almost. It just completely disappeared. And now there's very little pressure to do anything, especially when compared with the era of the 1960s.
Do you think that's good or bad?
Well...
Or neither.
I'm sort of ambivalent about it.
Uh-huh.
There's no question I think it helped. No matter who you were or what endeavor your expertise was in, if you had any degree of fame at all, you were expected to participate in the 1960s. And you were even badgered into it almost in ways of trying to prove that you were blacker than somebody else. You know, your afro was bigger than your dashiki was more African than the next black person's. That just completely disappeared in the 70s. And I can't find it at all in the 80s. And we know the reasons, but it's just sad to see it completely disappear because everybody now seems a bit more self-centered than they were before.
Mm-hmm. So you think some of those pressures that went along with the 60s were somewhat superficial, but on the other hand, you wish things were a little more political today?
Well, not so much superficial as someone like myself and quite a few people being in a position where if you were from the South, you were legally proscribed from doing a lot of things by whites.
Mm-hmm.
And here you were in the 60s being pressured into doing things by blacks who were in so-called leaders, positions of responsibility and influence. And you came to the point where you wanted to ask yourself, well, when do I get a chance to make up my own mind about something?
Uh-huh.
That's the situation I felt most deeply. All my life, up until I left school to go to college in California, I had whites telling me what I could and could not do, where I could and could not go. And all of a sudden, in the decade of the 60s, you have your black militants and other black leaders telling me what I should do solely because I'm black. And again, I would like to be able to make that decision for myself if I could once in life. But as far as tennis was concerned, for instance, the one area where I felt this tug both ways was in the issue of dealing with South Africa.
Yeah.
I was told in 1968 that if I wanted to go play in the South African Open, they probably wouldn't let me go because they don't allow blacks to play down there. Now, that had happened to me all my life as a junior in my own hometown, and I was in the position of saying, well, I'll be damned if that'll happen to me as a senior player. And when I wanted to go down there, you run into the opposition by some other blacks who say, you can't go down there because if you do, you'll be lending credence and credibility to that system. But I was just trying to prove a point that, hey, here's a country that said I can't play, and my position was, you either let me play or your tournament doesn't count. One of the two. Take your pick.
Mm-hmm. Athletes really have to be very single-minded to develop their abilities. And I'm wondering if it was hard for you to figure out how to divide your energies between civil rights actions that you participated in or speaking out on behalf of certain issues and devoting your time to your sport.
Very difficult, very difficult. I got in trouble once when I was stationed at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. I was an officer there and second lieutenant, and I made a speech in a black church in Washington that the Army thought was a bit too political. It was covered in the Washington Post, and I was called into the superintendent's office and told, in no uncertain terms, that if you do that again, you're going to be grounded, meaning we wouldn't be allowed to go out to play Davis Cup or whatever. Yet, you felt almost duty-bound to say something. Things were at such a fever pitch in 1968. That was the year, of course, when Dr. King was assassinated. That's when Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. That's when Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised their fists. And looking back on it, I don't regret it at all, even though I know Army regulations forbid anybody in the Army from engaging in political activity. But you just felt almost compelled to say something.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk with you more about your life in tennis and your life since retiring from tennis. But first we're going to take a short break, and my guest is Arthur Ashe, who has just written a 3-volume history of the African-American athlete. It's called A Hard Road to Glory. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest Arthur Ashe has just completed a 3-volume history of the African-American athlete called A Hard Road to Glory. Ashe himself is one of those athletes to travel that hard road to glory. He was the first black American male to win Wimbledon and to win many other tennis championships. He retired from playing in 1980 after quadruple bypass surgery. You've pointed out in your autobiography that when Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in tennis, when Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in baseball, there were a lot of black baseball players who were already excellent players playing in the black leagues and waiting to break in. So there was just the gates opened and there were great players right afterwards. But in tennis, it was different. There weren't as many black tennis players. So after you helped break the color barrier, there weren't as many black tennis players coming right in.
No, there weren't. In actual fact, to go back to the first half of your question, there were many more black, talented, capable players who could have played in the major leagues than were allowed to play. The major leagues let in black players after Jackie Robinson almost as if they were coming through a sieve. It was very, very slow. The first 14 years could be best described as token integration of the major leagues. Now, in tennis, there were two problems. One is that there was no huge black American history of having quite a few heroes, say like a Satchel Paige or Josh Gibson or Oscar Charleston, that the average black American had known about as far as baseball was concerned. There was no one who had tested their skills against white tennis players, and it was publicized in the paper. You have to remember that at the end of each season, for a long time, all-star aggregations of white major league players would get together and play against black teams to full houses around the country. And in most of these confrontations, the black teams almost inevitably won, and it garnered tremendous publicity, positive, for the black players. Now, that never happened in tennis, with the exception of one time in 1938, Don Budge came to Harlem to the Cosmopolitan Tennis Club and played an exhibition match against a current black champion, Jimmy McDaniel. And Budge won very handily and then played a doubles match afterwards. But that's the only instance where the best black players played at a very public venue against the best white players. And as such, black America just was never able to establish the momentum to produce enough tennis players to follow right behind Althea Gibson when she opened the door in 1950.
Well, I'm thinking, too, for instance, like all schoolyards have basketball hoops, you know, and in most schoolyards or in vacant lots, you can play baseball. There aren't that many tennis courts around in cities, especially, I think that's true, in black neighborhoods.
Well, there are tennis courts, but most of the expertise and the competitions are oriented toward the other team sports. And there's one very strong reason for that. And that is because those are the sports that are stressed in the public school systems.
Mm-hmm.
The public schools have four major sports: football, basketball, baseball, and track. All but track are team sports per se. Track is organized and run as a team competition, when in fact the performances are by individuals. And one of the reasons to do that, the chief reason, is that it's the best use of scarce athletic space. Now, a tennis court is 120 by 60, and you only get two people on it, and it takes a lot of space. So unless you live in Texas or California or Arizona where there's a lot of space, that's just not going to happen in a place like New York City, mm-hmm. where you have to resort to private facilities. And the best teaching is not to be found at your public park or your public school, as it is for basketball or baseball. It's to be found at a private club, which means you've got to pay for it. And when you have to pay for it, that in effect becomes a barrier, an economic barrier to progress.
You gave up tennis in 1980 after
Yes.
a heart attack and then quadruple bypass surgery. What are you able to do now athletically?
Oh, I stay fit. I mean, if one were to see me in person, I don't look any bigger than I did in 1980. I ride an exercise bike. I think the athlete in me left enough vanity for me not to get a pot belly or to get completely out of shape aerobically. So I'm still looking about the same as I did then.
You've said that you've worked for the Heart Association.
Yes,
headed up a campaign for them. Yeah,
right.
Well, you've said that most people who die of heart attacks die because haven't gotten quick enough attention. They deny they're having a heart attack. They think it's indigestion or something. That's actually what happened to you.
Yes, that is exactly what happened to me. And if it hadn't been for the doctor there, Dr. Lee Wallace, who just noticed my discomfort and asked some questions, I may have just sat there and died in the chair, for all I know. But he just very politely but firmly insisted that I come to the hospital with him, never mentioning the phrase heart attack at all. And, of course, we found out 2 days later after they've done the enzyme tests and got the results back that I indeed had had a heart attack. But, yes, in my work with the American Heart Association, it is stressed by cardiologists all over the country that the key to surviving a heart attack is not to deny that you have it, but get to a hospital, emergency room, and if there are no trauma cases, no gunshot wounds or knifings on the table, heart attack suspects go right to the front of the line.
Did you feel mentally prepared to retire from tennis?
Oh, yes. I was 36 years old, so it's not as if I felt cheated by this physical disability. No, not at all. I was probably going to retire at the end of that year anyway.
After you had become an athlete hero in the United States, after winning Wimbledon, your value as a... You became a symbol, and you became an important speaker. You became a symbol of great athletic abilities. You became a symbol to the black community. And you once wrote in your autobiography that groups started to get angry if you turned them down. And people would say, how can you not come to talk to my group? How can you deny these children the opportunity to meet in the flesh one of their great heroes?
Right.
How did you deal with those pressures?
Those were very difficult. And I tell you, it's a problem that wasn't just peculiar to athletes. Imagine what someone like a Bill Cosby or an Eddie Murphy or an Oprah Winfrey has to go through. They must receive dozens of requests per day. And we received our fair share of them. And you just cannot accept every single one of them, although you would like to be able to help out. But in the context of the seriousness with which people viewed their problems, and the fact that they always ask probably more than one black notable, they keep getting turned down. They start to think that these black notables don't want anything to do with them, and that is not the case at all. But if you're an athlete, you've got to have some semblance of single-mindedness about your work, and to that extent, you've just got to say no. And I certainly said yes more than my fair share of time, so I don't feel at all guilty about not having accepted a fair number of those engagements.
I have to point out that in your history of the African American athlete, there's a chapter on you. Was that one hard to write?
No.
You've been doing all this research on other people.
No, very easy. I wrote it in the third person, and no, it was very easy. I just tried to stick to the facts and write it the way I wrote in any all the others.
One last thing. Can you still play tennis?
Oh, I can, but I don't. I hardly ever play. My wife will drag me out every once in a while and play, and I'll tell you one thing about it, though. Your hands and your arms never forget. If someone were to just casually watch me play now, and I may play twice a year, you would think that I never stopped playing. But once they see me run, they'll understand that I've stopped a long time ago.
Do you not play for health reasons or for other reasons?
Basically health reasons. My heart situation is such that I really can't fully go all out to play. So if I can't do that, then I'd rather just not play at all.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us a little
bit. And thank
you.
I appreciate the forum.
My guest has been Arthur Ashe, and he's just completed a 3-volume history of the African-American athlete. It's called A Hard Road to Glory, and it's just been published by Warner Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Bela Lewitsky helped establish modern dance in Los Angeles, a city where the entertainment industry often eclipses the arts. But to earn a living, she often ended up dancing in movies. Now in her 70s, Lewitsky is still running her own company and is a founder of a new dance complex projected to open in 1990. Coming up, we meet Bela Lewitsky. Also, critic at large Laurie Stone examines what Jay Leno and his fellow comedians turned talk show hosts have in common. And in what can only be described as the ultimate journalistic scoop, we have news that hasn't even happened yet. A look back at 1989, courtesy of Robert Kaplow and the Punsters. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. Emperor Hirohito, who reigned over Japan for 62 years, died today of intestinal cancer. He was 87. Hirohito had held divine status until Japan's defeat in World War II. 55-year-old Crown Prince Akihito, the emperor's oldest son, immediately ascended the chrysanthemum throne. The first indictments and guilty pleas were announced today in the Pentagon fraud and bribery probe known as Operation Ill Wind. A federal grand jury indicted the Teledyne Company and six individuals. The Hazeltine Company and three other individuals pleaded guilty to other charges in the case. More from NPR's Phyllis Crockett.
According to the 86-page indictment, Teledyne Industries Incorporated and three of its executives, a civilian employee of the U.S. Navy, and two private consultants were co-conspirators who engaged in bribery and fraud. U.S. Attorney Henry Hudson, who is heading the nationwide multi-agency investigation, said at the heart of today's indictment was Stuart Berlin, a supervisory electronics engineer for the Navy who passed information on military contracts worth more than $100 million for radar-related equipment.
He sold information and his services to a private consultant who in turn sold that to the Teledyne Corporation.
Hudson said other indictments in the case involving the military's $150 billion a year procurement system are expected in the next few months. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Washington.
Debate continued at the United Nations Security Council today on the U.S. shootdown of two Libyan MiGs over the Mediterranean. U.S. Ambassador Vernon Walters displayed two large photographs of the MiGs, which he said showed the jets were armed with missiles. The Libyan ambassador branded the photos fake. The Security Council is not expected to vote until next week, and even if a resolution condemning the U.S. action is approved, it will likely be vetoed by the U.S. Soviet negotiator Yuli Vorontsov and leaders of Afghanistan's Muslim guerrillas failed to reach agreement today during a second round of ceasefire talks held in Pakistan's capital of Islamabad. Following 4.5-hour meeting, the leader of the rebel delegation revealed the reasons for the continuing deadlock. Phil Jones reports.
The chairman of the main Pakistan-based alliance of guerrillas, Mr. Sibgatullah Mojadidi, said afterwards that the Soviet side had confirmed that they would be withdrawing from the country by their promised deadline of February the 15th, but that was the only thing that the two sides could agree on. He said that the Soviets had proposed a ceasefire several times during the discussions, but they couldn't agree because the causes of the war, as they saw them, were still there. That was the continued existence of the Soviet-backed regime in Kabul, which again proved to be the main stumbling block between them. Professor Mujahideen said that their struggle would continue, although they had agreed to meet again, but no date or venue was mentioned. Leaving the meeting, Mr. Vorontsov would only confirm that a future meeting would take place sometime, and tomorrow he's due to hold a news conference after talking to Pakistan's Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto and before flying home.
The BBC's Phil Jones in Islamabad. Bomb experts from Czechoslovakia come to Britain next week to help establish whether Czech-made Semtex explosives, plastic explosives, blew up Pan Am Flight 103. Czechoslovakia has denied Semtex was responsible but offered to send experts to join in the forensic investigation. Meanwhile, West German intelligence officials quoted by the Reuters news agency say British investigators believe the bomb was planted by a worker at London's Heathrow Airport. Officials are downplaying earlier reports that the bomb was planted in luggage transferred from a connecting flight from Frankfurt. Stock prices were higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrial Average rose more than 3 points. You're listening to National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Last week at this time, you were probably partaking of two end-of-the-year traditions, the year-in-review analysis and predictions for 1989. Now that we're 1 week into the new year, Robert Kaplow and the Punsters have combined both of these traditions to put 1989 in perspective.
I'm standing high atop Times Square in an empty recording studio, listening to a compact disc sound effects library of crowd, wind, and car horns. And hearing it all, it's easy to remember what it must have been like when people walked around at night in large cities, when thousands could gather freely in the street, in those days before the robot policeman, before the computer virus, before the new depression. But let's look back on 1989, the year when it all started over. The trouble started in the winter of 1989. A computer virus, a prank by a Cornell graduate student, suddenly began infecting other computerized devices. Digital radios turned themselves on in the middle of the night, cars with electronic ignitions suddenly sped out of control, and in one of its more bizarre incarnations, pop singer Jay Black had his entire brain short circuit in the middle of a live performance of Cara Mia. We were, as President Quayle said that February, in big trouble. A society hurtling beyond speed and noise, beyond stress, falling apart at the seams. And the first thing to go was money. On the evening of November 1st, 1989, all bank records in America had suddenly gone blank. Infected computers had apparently erased themselves during the night. We were the richest society on Earth, suddenly gone completely bust. Men stood in line in the streets buying lotto tickets. Other men walked through Wall Street wearing sandwich boards reading Live Naked Models. We were, that summer, a nation starved for thrills. 1987 had seen the baby on board sign craze. 1988 had seen the Garfield cats with suction cup paws craze. And 1989 saw a new automobile craze. 40-foot inflatable Godzillas that you stuck out of the sky roof of your car, with huge bullhorns in their mouths so you could sing along with the radio.
Just a gigolo, everywhere I go.
Hey, Tony!
People know the game I'm playing.
And moving!
Pay for every dance.
Society was indeed disintegrating that summer, especially for young people. Among American teenagers, chocolate addiction was at an all-time high, and while chocolate couldn't be banned, a $40 million public service ad campaign tried its best to fight it.
Hi, I'm Evel Knievel. Some people call me a daredevil. Like the time I jumped the dangerous Snake River Canyon in my Sky Cycle, that was probably the greatest moment of my life. But I'll tell you something I'd never do. That's drink a glass of Bosco. No way, man. That's just stupid.
And the cry to save our youth went up again that August as 45 of the biggest names in rock and roll joined forces for a huge rally at South Africa's Cocoa Marsh Stadium. 11 billion people watched on television as Jay Black took the stage. The concert would end in a riot. Before it was over, 530 people would have lost their car keys. That fall, all musical concerts were banned. By September, all gatherings in public places were banned. And the cry rose from a ravaged American people, make the streets safe. And all of American technology responded with the L-Bots, squads of motorized robot policemen on roller skates who sang light opera. They were dressed like Elvis Presley, carried high-powered air rifles, and traveled in packs of 50. That winter, the streets belonged to the L-Bots.
I'm looking for someone. Could someone be you? I've looked high and low, and I haven't found you.
Hey, I'm just taking out the garbage. Hey, guys, I'm just walking the dog.
Now, wait a minute, fellas. All I told my class was we weren't going to say the Pledge of Allegiance.
Hey, boys, all I wrote was that I thought women should have the freedom of choice.
Yes, I'm a member of the ACL.
You.
I swear I didn't vote for Dukakis. You miss me.
Hey.
And then, maybe something snapped. Maybe human beings or society in general can simply take so much noise, so much madness, before some part of our essential humanness rebels and says, "My God, what are we doing?" For we suddenly, and startlingly, chose silence and reflection. It wasn't quite a religion. It wasn't organized. But it filled some longing as Americans, quite deliberately, that December of 1989, turned off the televisions. Let the Sunday Times turn yellow on the back porch unread. Got out of their cars. Put away the phone answering machines. Woke up with the sun. Noted the autumn. Raked leaves. Talked to neighbors. Slept deeply. Innocently. Profoundly. And that scared some people.
Hi, I'm Evel Knievel. Some people call me a daredevil. Like the time I jumped over Hoover Dam wearing only a jock strap, that was probably the greatest moment of my life. But I'll tell you one thing I'd never do. That's lie on my back and stare at the stars. No way, man. That's just stupid.
But life suddenly had changed. And as 1989 ended, men and women, through their own choices, searched for and found time and, apparently, each other.
"1989 in Review" was written by Robert Kaplow, performed by the Punsters, with music arranged by Tim Corzin. This is Fresh Air. Choreographer Bella Lewitsky says she eliminated the narrative from her dances because she believes dance is strongest when it's full of implication. She wants a dance to offer questions, not answers. Lewitsky is one of the pioneers of modern dance on the West Coast. Her career spans 5 decades. For 15 years, she was the star of the Los Angeles modern dance troupe founded by Lester Horton. Alvin Ailey is also an alumnus of the company. Since 1966, Lewitsky has headed her own company. Lewitsky says she works with dancers from the bones out. I asked her what that means.
I start really with alignment as the basis for my technique, which varies from what I learned from Lester in probably a few or a large number of areas. I start with a skeleton and want to make sure that it follows the physical laws of proper placement.
When you're realigning one of your dancers, what do you do? What are you doing?
I am asking that their hip not be thrust out to the back, creating a shortening of the lordosis area, nor the rib thrust far to the forward, amplifying that. That the shoulders not be pinched together but opened out, permitting an easy song-like breath through the thoracic cavity. And just asking that the skeleton be realigned and balanced so that it is as strongly functional as possible.
So it sounds like your choreography starts with therapy.
In some cases, the realignment starts with therapy, but my dance technique may begin with that, but it's the lesser aspect of it. I train to a level of strength and flexibility which should balance out so that hopefully my dancers will have an even amount of both. Also, I like simplicity of line, and I will undo, no matter how long it would take me, if I've made the mistake of hiring somebody who is highly mannered, I seldom do, I would undo that mannerism to have a look of simplicity in the body that goes out into space without interruption. That, for me, is probably the most single important look that I would want to create in a dancer, because from that, which is like a balance, a norm, a centering, you can move in endless directions.
You're one of the pioneers of West Coast dance. And, you know, a lot of people, no matter where they are in the United States, end up moving to New York because that is one of the dance and music capitals of the world.
Right.
What was behind your decision to stay in Los Angeles?
Probably the most dominant aspect of my decision to stay is that I'm a native Angelina. I respond, I think, emotionally, probably physically, and I suspect mentally, to being surrounded by desert sea and mountains. It's a very particular environment, and sun and space. I find it a productive climate for me. I visited New York. I much admire the things that occur in the dance world in New York. But remember that we are not really isolated.
Have the serious arts in Los Angeles been eclipsed over the years by the entertainment industry?
Oh, without question. The movie industry was totally dominant and consumed everything. And that community had very little liking for art, art in the sense of it's being a fine art.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever end up working in films temporarily?
That's how I earned my living.
Oh, really? What kind of work?
Dancing, always. But dancing in films, Pride and Prejudice, Anna Karenina, you know, I date back a bit.
Name some more.
And a whole set of RKO Oklahoma with Agnes DeMille, and there as her assistant, not as a dancer. And my mentor, Lester Horton, also earned his living in films. We did a whole series of films for Universal Studios. Yes, we earned our keep that way.
Do you think it was good for you to end up dancing in movies?
No. It's a way of earning a living.
But it took time away from your own dance.
Well, I was the oddity who, on a movie set, did not play cards, gossip, do my nails. I climbed behind some set and was working on a concert piece, which, incidentally, would make you a person slightly outcast from the Hollywood dancer.
You danced with Lester Horton's company from, I think it was 1937 to 1950.
You're probably right.
When you left, was it a hard decision to make? And did you ever worry that he would be offended because you were leaving?
Yes to both of those questions. We taught our classes in the theater, which meant that anyone teaching a class would have their back to the audience and facing the class. I didn't know that he was seated in the audience. And after I'd finished my class, he came up to me and said very quietly, "Bella, why are you not teaching my materials?" Well, he might as well have thrown a bucket of ice on me, because I hadn't the foggiest notion that I wasn't teaching his materials. I probably had already begun to develop a direction that was my own. That entered me into the process of, if I have done this, it's probably a time that I should be leaving.
You started your own company.
I did.
And you not only choreographed for it, you continued to dance till you were 62, I think?
Right.
That strikes me as a pretty old to keep dancing.
I have a strong body, and I never danced with my company because the age difference was incredible.
Oh.
So I danced solo parts within a company piece or did solos so that the contrast would not work as a detriment choreographically or to either the young people in my company or myself. But yes, I did dance until I was 62, and I think honorably. I mean, I was not really limping about the stage. Why? I still had a strong technique at 62.
Why was that your cutoff point? Why weren't you dancing at
63? For health reasons.
Uh-huh. You strike me as having a pretty remarkable body. And I was wondering if it's been difficult for you to accept the changes of aging, or if that hasn't been hard to accept?
Growing old is not the most wonderful thing that ever happened. I used to state that one of the best things that happens is you go in half price into the movie and you get half fare on buses when you grow to be old. There isn't a heck of a lot that's better about that. No, because you are beset by aging illnesses. All of us are.
You're in the position of working with young dancers who are gorgeous to look at, who are in fabulous physical shape. Do you ever get jealous of them?
No. I've had a rich and satisfying life, and this is another voyage for me. I head into what is now a last stage of my life, and it's full of information, too. It's amazing. Life's interesting for me. You learn, for instance, not to have the anxieties you had when you were younger.
Uh-huh.
Because like a Janus, you can see back and you can see forward and you are in the present. No young person has this capacity. And it's one of the gifts given to an older person.
I want to ask you about a project you're working on now, the Dance Gallery, which I think is scheduled to open in Los Angeles in 1990.
If you and I cross everything.
Now, this is going to be a space designed solely for dance performance.
Exactly.
Which is very unusual. Most dancers dance in theaters that were designed to accommodate all kinds of other performances.
Right, and what a friend of mine once dubbed purposeless facilities. And I've told her I use that expression over and over again because it doesn't work.
So what are you going to have for dance that other theaters
Sight lines which are as near perfect as we can make them, which means you line up the house directly with the stage. What we offer from the ground up is that we can head toward an ideal if we can afford it. Ample wing space, everything up off the floor that a dancer might trip over, of course a resilient floor surface, which is not usable if you have theater, if it's a shared facility with theater, because theater pounds into the floor.
Uh-huh.
A resilient floor for them is awful. And for a dancer, of course, the body is destroyed if it isn't a resilient flooring.
I wish you the best of luck with it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
Choreographer Bella Lewitsky. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a preview of All Things Considered. Robert, what's coming up today?
Well, we'll have a report from Bill Buesenberg about the town of Lockerbie, Scotland. It's where Pan Am Flight 103 crashed and what the crash has meant to that town. Also, news of guilty pleas in the Pentagon procurement scandal.
What else do you have in store for us?
Well, we have a gripping tale, which was briefly thought to be one of espionage. And it's about a dancer's videotape and resume which arrived at a Hartford, Connecticut art center with something strange inside the envelope.
Do you want to tell us what?
I'll tell you that they were slides and documents relating to U.S. war planes.
Very interesting.
Somewhere
Thanks, Robert.
At the bottom of it is the U.S. Postal Service.
We'll find out more about this story tonight on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Jay Leno is a familiar face on late-night television as Johnny Carson's substitute host. Critic-at-large Laurie Stone recently caught Leno in a live performance at CW Post College on Long Island. She has this review of his work.
In the comedy derby right now, Jay Leno's career is cruising faster than anyone's. He's appearing on talk shows, doing short bits of satire, and drawing material from the day's news. When subbing for Carson, he listens to his guests. He's better informed than Letterman or Carson, and he doesn't patronize. His big face, with its oversized jaw and plastic expressiveness, is frank and good-hearted. On stage live, too, his social conscience cuts through media hype with amusing results. He calls McDonald's idea of employing the elderly side by side with teenagers their cradle-to-the-grave minimum wage program. About the expiration date on Wonder Bread, he quips, "You should live so long." But his two-hour set often disappoints. Leno is likable for telling the truth, but he tells only a part of it. He defends the poor, but he has no other concrete politics. Not once does he mention the election, Central America, or even Gorbachev. His act is free of overt homophobia, but he assumes the males in his audience are straight. Affectionately teasing two guys, he predicts that after the show, they'll drink some beers and beat up homos, taking it for granted that neither is gay. Leno is awkward with women. There are as many females as males in the audience, but when he questions people about their cars, he addresses only males. Later, inquiring about the work people do, he speaks to 20 males and only 4 females, all of whom are called pretty lady. Part of Leno's TV success is rooted in what makes him bland when he performs live. He aims at such broad appeal, he's slippery, one minute ripping into junk food toxins, the next hawking chips in Dorito commercials. He's shy, self-protective, masked. For some stand-ups, I'm thinking of Sandra Bernhardt and Richard Pryor, comedy is a conduit for libido. Performing is a sexual act, a hit on the audience, a goose. And these performers electrify when working live. But for other comedians, smart-mouthing is an end-run around sex. It's no accident that the men with staying power on TV, and they are all men, project almost no eroticism. I'm talking about Carson, Cavett, Letterman, and now Leno. Carson is the perpetual coy boy. When his true feelings about women surface, they're lewd. Women are creatures you wed because they're idle, then despise because they're predatory. Cavett's libido is channeled into envy. His competitiveness has ruined him on the tube because it's so glaring it disturbs, like sex and violence in their more naked forms. Sex embarrasses Letterman. He says and shows this every opportunity he can. Leno is baffled by sensuality and turns priggish. Condom ads make him so twitchy he claims incorrectly that the U.S. makes a bigger deal of them than any other country. In fact, Britain has waged a tougher campaign for their use. Worse, Leno irresponsibly disparages rubbers before college kids, a population that's in dire need of information and protection. The bluff, shy guys who've made it on late-night shows all have the same tension in the shoulders, the same tightness in the voice, the same remoteness in the eyes. Medium cool is chilliest before bed, where there can be nothing threatening, nothing to jazz you up, just slumbering libidos to lull you past the arousing conflicts of consciousness.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic, and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, Seymour Shubin discusses his new mystery, Never Quite Dead. It was inspired by the photo of the body of a boy found in a box in a wooded area of Philadelphia. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new reissue featuring songwriter Hoagie Carmichael singing and playing his own songs. And television critic David Bianculli takes a second look at Tattingers. This NBC program is about to be revamped, and David doesn't think that's such a great idea. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Deborah Beagle. Research assistants from Tim Jacoby. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.